Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jason Minidakis, who is the artistic director of Marin Theater in Mill Valley. Jason is also the director of a new production of Waiting for Godot, which opens January 24th and plays through February 17th, and the director of another show this season, The Whipping Man, which was the 2011 Outer Critics Circle Award winner. I noticed that most of your plays you get from different sources, but every so often you go back to the canon, such as Glass Menagerie, Othello, even, I guess, Tiny Alice. I'm not sure if that's really canon. Maybe it is. What brought you to come back to look at Waiting for Godot, and what do you think you bring to the production?
When we go back to the canon, there tends to be multiple reasons for that to happen, and this was a perfect example of that being the case. I am a huge Beckett fan. Beckett is actually the reason that I kind of changed from my focus being English literature to dramatic literature. As we started studying Beckett in school, I went from Beckett to Pinter to a lot of the modernists, and that's really where I fell in love with the theater. And Waiting for Godot and Endgame were the two plays that really that I just fell in love with. I first directed Godot about 12 years ago at the Cincinnati Shakespeare Festival, and when I did it, I kind of made a promise to myself that I would try to revisit the play every decade or so. And every 10 years, I thought I hopefully would have something new to say to the play, and I'd revisit thinking about doing it again. And interestingly enough, right around 10 years from when I did my first production, I was up at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and I saw Mark Bedard doing A Servant of Two Masters, and he was playing the servant in the center of this crazy circus commedia production. And I honestly just started thinking, the next time I do Waiting for Godot, I want to work with Mark Bedard. I want him to be in the show. And so I started thinking about, you know, is it time to come back and visit the play now that I have an actor that I really want to work with? Around that time, we were also doing Tiny Alice, Edward Albee's play. Right. And I was working with Mark Anderson Phillips again, and I had worked with him before on Lucinda Coxon's Happy Now, and he's a fantastic actor, and he was playing the butler in Tiny Alice, and during rehearsal one day, we were on a break, and I came back in from the break, and Mark had been wearing boots as the butler, and he had taken them off and was playing with the shoes. He was sitting on the steps of the giant house that's part of the set, and he was playing with his shoes, and I immediately saw Estragon. And I knew kind of in that moment that I had Beckett's two clowns from Waiting for Godot. And so I started really thinking about revisiting the play. I took a read of it and had those two guys in my head, and it was just kind of perfect. So we have been working to get the production together since then. It's taken a little bit to figure out exactly when Mark Bedard was going to be available from Oregon Shakes, and when I could get both of those guys in the same room and have time to direct the play. So that was really part of the driving impetus to come back to the play, and that is in terms of, you know, why now? For me, I'm always ready to come back to Waiting for Godot because it is, for me, the quintessential comedy. You know, the play's title is Waiting for Godot, a tragicomedy, and a lot of people talk about, you know, the tragic part of the play, but to me, every single moment that you could even sort of say is tragic, even in it doesn't fit all the definitions of a tragedy by any stretch of the imagination, and the moments in it that are tragic aren't even tragic. It very much plays around with the idea of how do we spend time? How do we spend time with others? How do we waste time? How do we sort of lift something up to be worth defining our lives around? So if anything, for me, the darker moments are merely the troughs that the play rises out of continually. It is one of the most hopeful plays, in my opinion, that I have ever experienced, either as a director or as a viewer, because for me, the play is about how do we make it through our day and how do we choose to make it through our day. Godot stands for a lot of different things to a lot of different people. For me, it's actually not the Christian allegory that a lot of people see in the play. For me, is a very secondary, if not tertiary, thing, because the primary focus for me is that these two clowns are crafting their lives around something that they are waiting for, something that they expect is going to change their circumstances. That applies to everybody. We all have something that we can't stop making the center of our life that isn't necessarily the other people in our lives. And over the course of this play, we keep being reminded that ultimately what gets us from moment to moment is the people that we choose to be with, and that, you know, man is not a solitary creature. A lot of people look at this play as talking about man being a solitary creature, and I think it's about man being a social creature, and it's about how we always find someone who completes us, and how that partnership or that relationship makes our life worth living.
Jason Minidakis, having said this and having come with your own idea and your own interpretation of what this means, how does that interpretation affect how you direct the play?
It was critical to have two actors who were incredibly empathetic in terms of the audience really feeling for the people on stage. This is not a play that's very easy to do if Vladimir and Estragon, if the audience doesn't respond to them and react to them very well. That's one thing that's absolutely critical for the way that I'm working on the play. Another thing that's absolutely critical is that the actors have to have unbelievable comic timing and an understanding of comedy, both comedy that works through language, comedy that's physical, a comedic style of stagecraft, and they have to have amazing discipline as artists, because the silences, the pauses, the moments of silence that threaten to flood the play and to drown the play and to drown the characters and also the audience, those moments have to be at different times dead moments where absolutely no air is in the play. At other times, they have to be unbelievably filled in terms of the amount of interaction that's happening between characters without saying anything and without moving. And I needed actors who are very physically gifted in terms of the way they perform on stage and the control that they have over their body, over their rhythm of speaking. So the four actors that I have, I'm very, very lucky because, I'm working with Mark Bedard and Mark Anderson Phillips, but also we have Jim Carpenter playing Pazzo and Ben Johnson playing Lucky. And all four of these actors are unbelievably gifted in terms of their discipline. And that, for doing Beckett, is one of the most important things that you can have for an actor. So that being said, a lot of physical comedy comes into the way I work on the play. Beckett was a huge fan and a huge devotee of the burlesque theater, of the music hall, of the circus. These two characters are his version of the traditional clown that you see in all those different forms of theater and entertainment.
But Beckett doesn't necessarily say that they're tramps or clowns. The only thing he gives them are bowler hats.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't say anything. To me, they are absolutely clowns because of the routines that he gives them. Everything in the play is built around a type of performance routine, and then that routine gets repeated in different ways with slight modifications, either verbal modifications or physical modifications, timing modifications or purpose modifications, where the routines happen in the play in Act 1 versus in Act 2, how they play out. So you need artists with just a lot of talent physically up on stage, and we're working a lot on the text. We're doing about 4 hours of text work a day and then 4 hours of physical work a day. So it's kind of impossible to attack this play the way you would a normal play, where you do a lot of table work up front and then you really start staging the play, and perhaps you go back to the table when you need to, but you really, once you start standing the play up, you start working through the scenes, then you start getting some flow, then you start working the acts, then you try to start running the show before you get into tech, if possible. With Beckett, we are literally doing table work for half the day and then physical work for half the day. It's too much for the actors in terms of what they have to be doing mentally, in terms of their timing and their rhythm and the little runs and the routines that happen within the play. We work on those for part of the day, and then we stand up for part of the day. And sometimes we're doing the same material in both halves of the day, and sometimes we have to do entirely different material. At times it feels like we're doing a play. At times it feels like we're doing a circus. At times it feels like we're doing pure physical comedy. And so that's how I approach Waiting for Godot. It's a total theater mashup in terms of what's required from the artists that are doing the production. And I think that's what people are going to be perhaps most surprised about when they see the show, is how much physical theater there is involved in the play, and how much the silent moments and the quiet, still moments where nothing is happening, how those moments are set off from moments that are literally burlesque routines or, you know, music hall routines or circus routines. I don't know that that's necessarily unique to me, but that's how we're approaching the play and what people can be expecting.
Jason Minadakis, in a normal play, you know, you'd go on stage, you'd start with the blocking, but here it sounds as if the blocking comes out more from the rehearsals than it normally would, more from this kind of work.
There's a lot of pattern that I had to work on ahead of time in terms of where the repetitions were going to be and what the routines, what the broad outlines of the routines were going to be. And then the actors themselves, their talents with physical theater and with physical comedy really defined how each routine actually plays out. I'm bringing an idea of a shape, and then we're seeing how it fits the two of them as a team, or how it fits the four of them, in parts of the show. There's a great teamwork happening between me and them in terms of the overall structure of the play and then the details that happen inside. I'm more responsible for bigger shapes, and where their talents lie are really shaping how each routine is actually being played out on stage.
Jason Minadakis, how do you think this plays against most of the productions that people have seen?
I don't know. I've seen a number of different productions of Godot, and some of them are incredibly physical and very funny. And then, you know, other productions are very, very static. I don't think a lot of the routines and the physical side of the play are brought into full blossom in terms of the potential of what's there. You know, I've seen productions that were spawned from the staging of Beckett's original stagings that he did in the two productions that he directed in Germany at the Schiller Theater. You know, they are radically different, the two productions that he did there. And then, you know, the assistants who worked on those productions who have continued staging those productions in other places have been very faithful to what he did. You know, then you have the Fabulous Druid productions that have been happening and the Gate productions that both of those have been touring the States, and they have different levels of the physical comedy. And so I think everybody has a very different feeling for Godot. And I think the best thing about Godot is that it really adapts itself to the performers in it and what the performers' talents are that come to the play. It's a text that can take a lot of physical comedy and still retain the incredibly profound moments that happen within the play in terms of isolation, in terms of, you know, how we choose to live, how we choose to live with other people on our own. I always love seeing Godot, and that's the thing for me, is I can see numerous productions of this play because it does take so well to whichever artists are working on it, as long as they have a viewpoint that they're coming from in terms of how they're understanding the script and that it's consistent throughout the play, because the play does demand an understanding of pattern and routine and repetition and the evolution of repetition. If you don't get that, then the play, for me, can really fall apart and can really lose its comic side, because a lot of what's very funny about the play is how the routines change or how they don't change, how they expect them to change and then they don't, the characters inside of the play.
You're listening to an interview with Jason Minadakis, who's the artistic director at Marin Theater Company in Mill Valley and the director of the upcoming production of Waiting for Godot, January 24th to February 7th. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book. You're not worried, let's say, about motivation of the characters or anything. That's pretty much going to be left to the actors at that point, because you've chosen actors who will do that.
Yeah, we talk a lot about why things are happening in the play. Why are they waiting? Why are they coming back to this appointment every day? But Beckett also does an amazing job of putting that all in the text, if you know where to look. they explain, they tell you why they're there and why they're together, and you know, they have arguments about whether or not they should separate, and then they have arguments about why they should stay together. So you really do find all of that motivation inside the text. He's not vague about it. That's the interesting thing to me, is that for a play that so many people feel is so unbelievably vague, to me it feels terribly specific. Beckett always said that he thought it was perfectly clear what was happening in the play. He and Albee kind of have this thing where they kind of refuse to explain their plays because to a degree they feel like they're easy to understand if you just watch and don't bring a lot of preconceived notions to them. So,
do you think that's the case with Tiny Alice?
I do, to some degree. I think the trick with plays like Tiny Alice and Waiting for Godot is you hear so much about the plays and what they mean before you ever see them. And, you know, plays like Hamlet and plays like Romeo and Juliet, you get them put in a box before you actually experience them. So you're coming to them with a set of ideas that may be very specific to a very specific production, or may be very specific to a time period. You know, we just did It's a Wonderful Life version of it, and one of the things that was surprising was explaining to people that when the movie first came out, it was a bomb. The movie did not do well at all. The reason that it became an American classic is because it ran out of its copyright, and TV stations were able to air it without paying any royalties all through Christmas, so they just put it on a loop. The way we view things in different time periods really reflects who we are as a people and how we've changed. And, you know, It's a Wonderful Life was too dark when it first came out. And, you know, as our sensibilities change and as our taste for material shifted and became different or came back to an earlier time period, because, of course, you know, the darkness of It's a Wonderful Life isn't near as dark as the darkness of the original Christmas Carol, the story, you know, when Dickens originally wrote it. I would say that's very similar to Waiting for Godot.
What got me about It's a Wonderful Life was, if you listen to the words of Mr. Potter, the evil guy, they sound like Mitt Romney.
That play today has a really special significance just because of, you know, the idea of people losing their homes and right. And what a crash can do to an economy and what it can do to a community. So I think that's, you know, that was one of the wonderful things about seeing, you know, It's a Wonderful Life up on stage again was to get to hear how cyclical time is and how, you know, we're at a place right now that's not all that different from where people were right after the Great Depression, because the crashes and what they did to the economy were so similar. And, you know, I think coming out of that time period is where Beckett got his inspiration for writing Godot. You know, it was after World War II. He had just returned to France, you know, and he was dealing with the fallout of what had happened with World War II. He was looking at, you know, the European landscape had changed so dramatically. Obviously, it had changed with the loss of, you know, numerous family members, sometimes their entire family. And then to come back and to try to understand how that had happened and how people had let that happen. And what were people waiting for to stop what was happening, and how were they living their lives based on seeing or not seeing? I mean, I think all of that influenced where he went with Godot in terms of a landscape that is empty, save for the tree and the sun and the moon and the rock. The theater is very revealed in this production, and the routines of theater and the routines of entertainment and how those routines came out of our daily routine. You know, it's funny that when you think about most clown routines are routines that people go through in their day. The clown routines are just taken to an extreme, and they're taken to an extreme to make them funny. That's sort of the essence of drama, and Beckett has taken it and played around with isolation and loneliness and the whole concept of building your life around something that's going to, if you just get it, it's going to transform your life.
It's always just out of reach.
Right, right. Whether it's, you know, whether it's that new car, or whether it's that new job, or whether it's that new relationship. And, you know, when I say relationship, that can be any kind of relationship, a worshipful relationship, a romantic relationship. So for me, that's Godot, is that unattainable thing that if you get it, it will change everything. And how do you build your life around trying to wait for that to happen versus living your life every moment in every moment? And that's what these two clowns do. We watch them make the most out of every moment while they're also trying to wait. And it's very funny and very hopeful because they keep making it through. They think they can't. They think they're just, if he doesn't come, they feel like, you know, it's the end. But they keep finding ways together of turning their sad situation into a funny situation and making it through together.
As you talk, I keep thinking, you know, is it possible for Beckett, maybe for Shakespeare, maybe for Albee, I'm not sure, is it possible that you can over-research?
Yeah, I think you can always over-research any play and any piece of art. If I could wish something for us as a people, it would be that we could always come to a play fresh and that we could always return to a play fresh without having heard about it. I would also love for people to be able to read as much as and hear all about it and talk all about it and then revisit it. But then I would love for them to be able to forget everything and go to the play fresh again if they so chose. I think any play needs to be experienced its first time where you know nothing about what you're about to see.
Would it be better than, I think that's mostly impossible, but it would be better than for, say, Shakespeare or any of the great playwrights to avoid reading the play before you see a production?
No, not necessarily. I mean, for me, I would prefer that no one heard that Shakespeare had really complicated language, or that the language was really rich with imagery, or that it was, you know, beautiful poetry. I wish those what descriptors that are actually barriers to people enjoying something. You know, if you don't tell someone they're seeing Shakespeare and you stick them in the play and you have the play start, most people won't actually be confused by what they're hearing. You tune in, you listen for the patterns, you listen for how you're being told the story, and you normally accept it and run with it. It's very infrequently that we go into something and we shut down if we haven't heard anything about it. It's when we've been told, you know, Shakespeare's, he writes in poetry, and, you know, and when you're told with Waiting for Godot, you know, the famous quote is that nothing happens twice, right? When you see the play, most people walk out of it saying, I don't understand how that quote applies to the play. But unfortunately, a lot of people hear that before they see it, and they think that nothing happens. And that is the entire opposite of the experience of the play.
The way you speak, is that the way you approached Othello?
Yeah, I think so. We wanted to approach Othello from the idea, we had a couple ideas. We wanted to make sure that as we did the play, that we took a fresh look at it, and that's one of the reasons why we made it a society where men and women could be any profession they wanted to. We wanted Desdemona to choose to be with this man and to be his wife and to choose to be that and not something else, where other women could choose to be other things. We also wanted to make sure that Iago, first and foremost, was trustworthy, that the audience understood why the other characters on stage were trusting him, because I think that play can fall apart quickly if you don't think that Iago is trustworthy, if you think that all the other characters are getting duped and you don't understand why they believe him. And that's also important for the character of Othello. And one of the things that we wanted to approach with Othello was to make sure that Othello did not believe the slander about Desdemona too easily. You know, one of the great commentaries about that play is that Iago has to convince Othello twice that his wife is cheating on him. And we took the tack that it doesn't work the first time. We tried to hold off Othello biting into the idea that his wife is cheating on him. That's the scene where he gets really physical with Iago and ends up right, picking him up and slamming him on the ground. We played it as far as we could push it to the idea that that Iago was in real physical danger, and Iago really had to sell his terror and his feeling of being wronged for not being believed, which merely made Othello confused. He didn't bite into the bait yet. Do you know what I mean? So we still had another scene where Iago came back and went at him again, and that time Iago was able to convince Othello that Desdemona was cheating on him. Too often, I think, you feel in that first scene that Othello has taken the bait, and we did everything we could to try to make sure, as the language indicates, that Othello hasn't bought into it, that he's merely just really confused with all this information.
It sounds, in listening to you talking about these shows and Tiny Alice, it sounds as if one of the most basic elements, then, is a close, very close reading of the text.
Yeah, always. I think everybody tries to do that. The thing about working in the theater is that the text is where we begin with playwrights. You know, if it's a text-based performance, that's where we begin. You know, if it's an improvised performance, we begin with an idea that we work around. But the theater that we do here, you know, and most theater that you will see around town is theater that's based on a writer's written work, and you have to start there. You know, we try to be careful of not laying our ideas on top of it, but trying to get to the heart of what the writer's trying to get to.
So you're not trying to rewrite the play?
Hope not.
Let's talk a little about the upcoming productions. Whipping Man, which comes after Waiting for Godot, you're also directing. Does that put a strain on you to be directing two plays at once?
It sure does. It fell together because Whipping Man ended up being a co-production with Virginia Stage Company, and we had to make the timing work for both organizations. And we had gotten a little bit down the road in figuring out where we were going to be able to do Waiting for Godot so that Mark Bedard from OSF could be part of the production. And it all shook out in such a way that they had to end up going back-to-back. So I'll open this show on, I think we officially open on January 29th, and then I fly to Virginia on February 2nd and start rehearsals on February 5th. So 1 week after we open, I'll be in rehearsals in Virginia for Whipping Man.
Do you ever come back to a production and do notes once it opens? I mean, is this going to be a problem?
No, not at all. I come back and see productions every couple of weeks. I have a phenomenal stage manager here who really understands how I work as a director, and I'm very lucky that since I've been at Marin, I've had fantastic stage managers, and they've done a great job of keeping an eye on the shows and helping to keep the actors within the parameters that we set up in rehearsal. It's going to be different with this play because I will not see it again before it closes, which is kind of heartbreaking because I am having such a ball with these actors that this is one of those shows, and Godot is one of those plays for me, that this is probably one that I would see much more frequently than other plays, but I will be out of town the entire time the play's running, even if it extends. So, yeah, I won't get to see it.
Well, the other problem is that I've talked to enough directors who say, well, you know, with our very, very short preview period, this is true for Berkeley Rep, for ACT, with the short rehearsal period and the short preview period, it isn't sometimes until a week and a half into the production that it reaches its apex.
Exactly. That's true. And that's the great thing about having a company that you can come back and see the shows. It'll be disappointing not to see it, but that happens.
Whipping Man is a very strange show. It's about two slaves and the son of former slaves and the son of their master during the Civil War, and they're all Jewish?
Yeah, they are. The play takes place a few days after the Emancipation Proclamation in April 1865. The slaves have just been freed by Lincoln, and we're in a home in Richmond, Virginia after the siege of Richmond, so Richmond's already fallen. Over the course of the play, Lincoln makes his appearance in Richmond, and one of the former slaves actually sees him and has an interaction with him. But the household that these two slaves have worked for, and one of them has been brought up in, both of them actually have been brought up in, it's a Jewish household. This family decided to raise their slaves in the Jewish faith, which, believe it or not, is not, this isn't a fiction. There were many Jewish households in the South that had their slaves become Jews. They were raised in the Jewish faith, and they were part of their family in that way. The problem with that, if you know Torah, is that one of the things that Torah says is that you can keep slaves, but you cannot make bondsmen out of your brothers. And your brothers in the Torah mean people who are of the same faith. So there's an elemental problem at work in the play in that these men have been raised both as slaves and as fellow Jews to the homeowners. And when the play starts, the family has left, and one of the older slaves and one of the younger slaves have been left to take care of the house throughout the siege of Richmond, and the son of their owners shows up, and he's been a Confederate soldier. He's been a captain in the Confederate Army, and he's got a leg wound. And he comes home on a horse that drops dead as soon as he gets in there, and he's the bullet wound. I'm not giving anything away because this all happens in the first 10 minutes. They have to amputate his leg. It's already starting to poison his blood. And the men end up having to take care of him because obviously he can't take care of himself. He's recovering from the amputation that they do in the living room. Then you start to discover the secrets of this family, and it's a beautiful, fascinating look at brotherhood and at what does it mean to be brought up in a faith together, but, you know, to have very different prospects for the future. Lincoln gets assassinated over the course of the play, so they have to deal with that as well. And then they have to deal with trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future. How are these two men going to go from being, they've been slaves all their lives, how do they now transition to being freemen?
How did you find the play?
The playwright's agent actually sent me the play, and when I opened it and saw on the first page that it was set in Richmond, Virginia, they had me hook, line, and sinker, because I was born in Richmond and raised there, and so I knew the area of town that they were talking about, and, you know, I grew up in the town and knowing all about its history as the Confederate capital, and, you know, Virginia history was a separate class. We had U.S. history and Virginia history, so they had me on the first page, because I've never actually seen a play that was written that was based in Richmond, Virginia. So
was this before or after it won the award?
Before. I was actually able to see the production in New York at Manhattan Theater Club. I didn't see the original production in upstate New York or the production down at the Old Globe, but I was able to see the production that Andre Brower was in at Manhattan Theater Club and in their small theater. It was a great production. Doug Hughes did a really great job with it. Ours is going to be different, no question, but that's because we have very different actors. We've got a great San Francisco cast that's going to Virginia with me to do the play. Peter Callender and Toby Windham and Nick Pelzar. So it's a really great company. I'm really excited to go to Virginia with them and then bring them back here. And, you know, when audiences get to see the play in Marin, the actors will have been doing the play for 2 months. So that's going to be very different because, you know, normally you have your, you know, 4 or 5 week rehearsal period here, and it takes another week or two for the play to really get its legs under it. Well, this play is going to have a 3 week rehearsal period, a 1 week preview process, and then 3 weeks of run. And then we're going to come back for another 2 weeks of rehearsal before anybody sees it here. So these actors are really going to have the show under their belt by the time we open. So it'll be great. I'm really excited.
Jason Minidakis, what brought you to Martin McDonagh's Beauty Queen of Lenoir, which was the first McDonagh play I saw in New York?
It was the second McDonagh play that I experienced. The first one I was lucky enough to see Cripple of Inishmon before I saw Beauty Queen. And I loved those first couple of plays that he wrote. I thought they're the first couple of plays that were produced, actually. I thought they were amazing. Beauty Queen of Lenoir actually hasn't been done professionally in the Bay Area since the Berkeley Rep production in 1999. You know, when we were looking to put the season together, we were looking for a dark comedy to kind of complement everything that we were doing. And I was, you know, looking for another family play that would play off of what we had done this year with Top Dog Underdog and with Whipping Man, because both of those plays have very strong family elements to them. So I was looking for a dark comedy that had family, and I was kind of curious in finding a mother-daughter relationship because, you know, Top Dog Underdog was two brothers, and then Whipping Man is all men. So I wanted a female family play, and Ryan Roletta, producing director at the time, was really interested in directing Beauty Queen, and it had been on our board for quite a while. We had both Beauty Queen of Lenoir and Skull and Connemara up on the board, so we were bouncing back and forth between which one, and Skull and Connemara is a much more male-driven play, so those were all reasons that we wanted to come back to Beauty Queen. You know, we thought it was time to see the play again, and we knew there were some fantastic Bay Area actors that would do the play justice, and, you know, we ended up with a fantastic cast. We've got Joy Carlin is playing Mag, the mother. Beth Wilmert is playing her daughter. Rod Knapp is playing the love interest. So it's a great company, and Mark Jackson will be directing the play. It's a great story that people haven't seen for, hopefully, you know, quite a few years. It'll be fun to return to it.
Before we went on the air, Jason Minidakis, you talked about next season. You said that you're waiting on a play that you folks have developed to see how you're going to fit the other plays around that. Is there any theme to the plays that you've selected?
One of the things that we always look at here is how do the plays interconnect, and what will we be talking to the audience about over the course of the season. You know, we try to make sure that at least two plays are always in conversation with each other as we put them together. And right now, we have a pool of about 10 plays, I would say, that maybe more like 12, that if we can do the play that we've commissioned, that we've been developing, it will shake out, and we will see how the rights shake out with some of the other plays that we're waiting on. And then all those themes and everything, we'll figure that out as we're trying to figure out which plays partner together and work best together. Right now, it is a totally open slate. It's kind of crazy that we're at this point in the year, and we're still not locked down on a few things, but what we're hoping is that once that first piece locks into place, the other five pieces will lock down pretty quickly. We've got some phenomenal pieces that we're really excited about, so we'll see how it shakes out.
When you're talking about having a dialogue with each other, what are the plays from this season? I would think Whipping Man and Top Dog Underdog, is that pretty much it?
No. Since this is about Godot, we put It's a Wonderful Life and Waiting for Godot back-to-back.
Oh.
And a lot of people talk about how It's a Wonderful Life is about, you know, what is your life? What's valuable in your life? Waiting for Godot is the same thing. Okay. Both of the plays were written in the mid-20th century. Two different mediums. One is an American perspective on what's your life worth. One is a European perspective on what's your life worth. I think they have an amazing conversation back and forth between them. George Bailey loses something and needs something to happen to make his life worthwhile. Vladimir and Estragon are waiting for something to happen that's going to make their life worthwhile, and we watch them examine their life or live out their life, and we watch how they value the people that are around them and how that's really the center of what their life is in both plays. And a lot of people thought it was really funny when we had Wonderful Life and Godot back to back, but it was very intentional. I think the conversation that people are going to have about those two plays and how those two plays are so much about how we define what happiness is, I think it's going to be a great conversation. And then, you know, just to kind of spread it out a little bit, yes, absolutely. Top Dog Underdog is a view of African-American life, you know, from the urban contemporary perspective. Whipping Man takes a look back, you know, right when African-Americans first achieved their freedom and had, you know, all those questions about who are we going to become and how are we going to do it. So those two plays obviously have a conversation. But also, we put the first play of the year, Circle Mirror Transformation, next to Top Dog Underdog for a very specific reason as well. Circle Mirror Transformation is an hour and 50 minute, slow, evolving, beautiful poem of a play where the entire play is very softly spoken. The characters don't quite say what they mean. There's a lot of silence in the play, and it takes an hour and 10 minutes for some things to even develop so that the audience can even begin to understand why they're watching the play. Top Dog Underdog is like a machine gun blast of language. From the minute the play starts, you get as many words in the first 5 minutes of Top Dog Underdog as are probably in the first half of Circle Mirror Transformation. We wanted that theatrical sense. We wanted our audience to go on that journey and to have very different stylistic experiences of language in those first two plays and two very different explorations of how a story is told. You know, they're so different in terms of how you receive them through your ears, not even getting into the other senses, but just how you receive those plays by their ears. That's why those plays were back to back.
For me, the idea that I should be, when I'm seeing one play, in a way, observing the previous play or the previous plays is not something I necessarily do, but yeah. I should be doing it.
No, I don't know that you necessarily should. What I hope is that after you go home, you start talking about how this play, well, how does this play interact with that play, and why did we see those two plays back to back? That, to me, would be the best thing. If you think about it while you're seeing the play, I guess that's good. I always hope that when you're in a play, we are so captivating your sight and your sound and your thinking with that story that you're not comparing the plays. But, the minute the Q&A begins, the minute the intermission begins, I hope, you know, and the minute the people get in the car, they start talking about, well, this has been an interesting season because we had that first and this next. And you know, one of the things, I'll leak one thing. One of the things we're really looking at for next year is the American family. And a lot of the plays from next year are about family and what lengths we go to make a family and what lengths we go to keep that family together. There's some hopefully just brilliant new American theater in next season. So cross your fingers.
You've been listening to an interview with Jason Minidakis, who's the artistic director of Marin Theater Company. You could find more information out at marintheater.org. Waiting for Godot plays January 24th through February 17th. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.